Hi, I'm Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, welcome back to another edition of Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration between Hungry Magazine and Chicago Magazine, and you can find all of our podcasts at www.hungrymag.com or www.chicagomag.com. This month I sit down with Carol Wallach of Solar Restaurant. Chef Wallach is a former surfer who grew up in California and worked as a celebrity chef to stars like Jack Nicholson and James Garner. These days she's making waves here in Chicago at her Cal-Asian American restaurant Sola, which celebrates its second anniversary this January. Enjoy the interview.
Your second anniversary is coming up. I wonder what your expectations were when you were starting out. I mean, obviously you wanted to last 2 years, but, you know, how has it gone? Has it exceeded what you thought you'd be at, or, you know, where...
I think that it has far exceeded our expectations. Although, you know, it's never enough. You know, you always want more and more and more, but the end result is I'm shocked and very proud of everything we've done and continue to do. I think the menu evolves constantly. The service evolves. Our wine list evolves. And I think that's great, but it goes back to the old adage, be careful what you wish for, because I'm very tired. You know, I work a lot because we're busy.
Much has been made about your career as a surfer. I wondered if you'd talk about that a little bit, what that was like back in those days, and, you know, kind of where you were at, and, you know, how far you went with that. You know, I think it's just, it's obviously a really fascinating thing, so...
Well, I think it's very fascinating here in the Midwest because you don't have surfers.
Right. Unless you're surfing like Lake Michigan storm squalls.
Right. I grew up on the West Coast, and I grew up surfing in Malibu. And I grew up surfing at a time where there weren't many women in the water. Gidget, who I know you probably know the story of Gidget, is a real person. And she was one of the very few women in the water. And it was a hard...
Like the Sally Field. Like,
right, but Gidget is a real
based
person.
Based on a real person, yeah.
What is her name? Anyways, there weren't that many women, and when I first entered the culinary industry, there weren't a lot of women. So, but I was used to that, being a woman fighting into a man's world. So that sort of was second nature to me. I'd done it once before. Surfing was my life. It was what I wanted to do. It was what I had hoped to do. I really wanted to be a professional surfer, and I did do a lot of competition, and I traveled around the surfing world for quite a while, but I was never good enough, and I never won. And back in those days, there wasn't a lot of money for women in surfing. These days, it's a lot different, and these days, the world champion is a six or seven time world champion, and she's phenomenal. And I doubt I could have ever competed with someone of her caliber. But I just never made it, so I had to figure out something else to do.
I guess you met somebody who was working at Spago, is that right? Or who had worked at Spago at the time?
I did. I met a girl on the beach. On days that the surf wasn't very good, I would play volleyball at another beach near my house. And there was a girl that played volleyball there a lot, and she was also the executive chef at Spago, or the chef de cuisine under Wolfgang, and she would talk all the time about her stories of working in the kitchen, and I was very enamored with it. I was just always listening, and I introduced myself to her, and we became friends, and I was just fascinated. And I think that the immediate gratification of the culinary world, to me, was very appealing because that's the type of person that I am. And so then it was history.
Yeah, you were kind of there in the real big boom, I mean, of California cuisine, right? I mean, that was Wolfgang and Nancy Silverton and, you know, all these people at that time were just kind of getting their feet and, you know, getting their legs set and moving up in the world. I wonder what that was like to be there sort of on the edges of that explosion and just there at that time.
Well, Alice Waters was always a culinary goddess to me. My mother loved Chez Panisse. And so my father would fly my mother up to Berkeley, or up to San Francisco and then to Berkeley, to dine there for her birthday or something like that. And it was the explosion of that style of cooking, you know, when I was first getting involved. I was always very intrigued. Nancy Silverton is actually someone I went to grade school with, and we went to private high school together and carpooled together. Nancy is phenomenal. I've always just been in awe of what she did. However, on the other side of that, I've never had an interest in pastry or bread making. I've always done savory. She was, you know, someone I always looked up to because she's incredibly talented. And a smart businesswoman.
Yeah, obviously. It's funny that you mentioned that about Chez Panisse, because I know when I went to Napa, even now, like 30 years later after it had been opened, you know, I went to the French Laundry and I went to all these places. And, you know, of course I remember the French Laundry, but Chez Panisse, for me, was as good as the French Laundry in its own way. It was so... And it's like, you know, here's a place that's been open for like 30 years, and, you know, you know, people can lose the top of their game, but they're doing something marvelous there. That's still, there's so much about community, you know. Like, I love, you know, we were there and we were sitting next to these people, and it was like late August, early September, and it was sort of the last of the heirloom tomato season, and I was kind of looking at the heirloom tomatoes they had, and then they also had like a whole beet thing, and I was like trying to decide between the two, and I couldn't, and I finally just went with the beets. And I was talking to the guy next to us and telling him about my dilemma, and this was just another patron who was sitting at the restaurant. And when he got the tomatoes, and like halfway through the meal, he's like, "Oh, you want a bite?" You know, I was like, that's the kind of thing that I don't know that has ever happened to me in Chicago. It might. I mean, Midwesterners are pretty friendly, but I mean, it was just like this guy didn't know me from anybody, and he was like, "Hey, you should try this," you know. And it was like, you know, that's the kind of feel you get at a place like that, which I think is sort of maybe what you're trying to foster here as well, right? I mean, it's a neighborhood restaurant. I mean, it's beyond a neighborhood restaurant in the quality of the food, but you know, it's in a nice area. You've got a lot of community and a lot of neighborhood around here. Is that true, do you think?
Yeah. We are definitely a destination spot. We are also a neighborhood restaurant, and I think that we have elevated the neighborhood restaurant, as you said, to a fine dining restaurant. And I think that there's no reason to go downtown if you want a fine dining experience. You know, I don't like going downtown.
Yeah.
There's certain restaurants certainly I would go for, but just the ordeal of the parking and the driving downtown, I would much rather stay in a neighborhood. I think that's what we really wanted to do. You know, just getting back to what you were saying about Chez Panisse and how friendly, I don't know Berkeley that well, and I would imagine people at Berkeley are much friendlier than Los Angeles. But I think it's the atmosphere of the restaurant that just fosters that, because it's such a warm and inviting feeling, and it's a camaraderie of getting together and loving the natural, organic, you know, foods that they create, and everything is just spectacular, that you just are so joyous eating there that you just want to share it with everyone. And I think that's probably where that comes from.
One of the things I think you've emphasized is this idea of, you know, cooking to comfort people or to give people something they need. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, and, you know, how you gauge that and what you think people need, or how you understand that as a cook.
Well, I think what people don't need is over-processed, you know, over-buttered, that kind of food. But I think that what we offer is fresh food, organic food, or natural and beautiful fresh fish and fantastic meats, whether they're braised or just grilled. And we are also very open to people's likes, dislikes, allergies, or, you know, food issues, where if somebody has some weird issue because they had a bypass or something, we will accommodate people. I don't like going to restaurants when, well, no substitutions. I won't do that. You know, we'll do just about anything for a guest, because I think it's important. You want people to feel like they can get what they want. I can't rewrite the menu, and I can't make them a plate of spaghetti because we're not an Italian restaurant, but we will do pretty much anything. And I think that we offer a really good quality menu. You know, everything is fresh, everything is lovely. It's very creative, yet it's approachable. And I think the approachability is really important. I have a hard time dining at a restaurant where there's words on the menu that I don't understand. And it, maybe it's not so much me as it is Steve, my boyfriend. You know, he'll look at a menu and he doesn't understand what it is. And I think that that is something that people don't necessarily want.
Yeah, it's too technical in a way or something like that. I mean, nowadays what you're seeing, I think, is people are like putting glossaries at the bottom of their...
Yeah, footnotes. There's a footnote telling you. You can open up 3 reference books and find out what that is.
Yeah.
I just think it needs to be approachable and good. And these days I think people are really focused on health and well-being and, you know, what you put in your body, you are what you eat.
I know one of the things you have on your menu, you call sea greens, which I think is like seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's something that people are becoming more aware of, especially those who are sushi connoisseurs. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. And, you know, I don't know if people are aware of the variation in sea greens or seaweed that's available and, you know, that there's a lot of nuance there. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
I love seaweed of all different kinds. Our salad in particular is with hijiki. You know, there's a lot of different kinds. One, it's very healthy for you. 2, it has a lovely aroma, the aroma of the sea and the flavors. And I think that because of the fascination with sushi and the love of sushi in this country, it's becoming certainly much more approachable. It's just another wonderful organic food or good quality natural food that you can consume.
Do you have any sense of it that it's kind of like where mesclun was 30 years ago, or like, you know, these mixes of like wild greens that people didn't really know about? Everybody just knew about iceberg at the time, and, you know, seaweed is kind of like at that level now where it's kind of like, you know, it could blow up. There's a lot of different ways to use it and serve it, but people aren't using it yet, but it's on its way.
I think that's a really good point that you make. It is like the mesclun greens of many years ago, where it is right on the verge. I don't know how you would use it in different styles of cooking. I guess maybe I'm not that creative, but you know, in Japanese cooking and in a lot of different Asian ethnicities, they've been using it for many years. I think that, you know, what we do here is we take those Asian flavors and make them very Americanized, so to speak, so that they're more approachable, and so we're able to use something like seaweed with something else that so people become familiar with it.
One of the things you've talked about, and you just made allusion to it a few minutes ago, was this idea of going into the kitchen as well as being a surfer. It was sort of this idea of entering sort of a male-dominated world. Yeah, obviously with the kitchen, I mean, that's the thing, is like so many of the top chefs, so to speak, or whatever, happen to be males. I wonder, you know, is it harder for a woman still? I mean, even today, you know, I mean, you see a lot more women. You know, what was that like coming through those ranks? And, you know, what kind of things did you have to do to kind of assert yourself and succeed?
I think that it still is very difficult for a lot of women. And I think that there are still a lot of men that don't respect women. There's a lot of different cultures that don't respect women as a boss. But even a young woman coming up in the ranks, you really have to fight your way in. And it's sad that society hasn't changed that much, but it is what it is. When I started, one of my first jobs, I got stuck peeling carrots for probably a year. But I sat in a corner peeling baby carrots till I had no knuckles left. And it was just this very chauvinistic French guy that, you know, maybe had to hire me. I don't know if it was a quota issue, you know, but, you know, he just left me in the corner peeling baby carrots. I like to give young women a chance. I do a lot of stages with young women. You have to go in, and whether you're a male or a female, you have to show that you're there for a reason. I, for instance, had a young man doing an internship from culinary school, and he made the same thing every day because he was comfortable with that. And I was like, if you do that one more day, I'm done with you. You're here on an internship when you have the opportunity to learn so much. And I find that young women are more inclined to do more because they have to be accepted and to stay. You know, it is a tough world. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. You didn't go to culinary school. I know one of the things you said to me was, you know, going to culinary school doesn't make you a good cook, just like going to medical school doesn't make you a good doctor, which I think is a great analogy. Does it free you more not to have gone to culinary school in some ways, too? I mean, I know a lot of things I hear nowadays is that you have all these kids going to culinary school, and, you know, they all watch Food Network, and then they come out, and they want to do, like, you know, pan-Indian Mexican fusion or something, you know, and it's all really confusion, as they say. Yeah, I wonder if having not gone to culinary school, you know, you're not afraid to break rules because you don't know what those rules are or how that works for you.
I think you are not afraid to break rules. I think that, and it's a labor of love. You have to love what you do, and you have to have that creativity and that willingness to just try things. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I don't suggest trying it on a Saturday night and putting it on your menu until you've tasted it, which some people do. But you just got to give it a shot, and it's just food. And it's so much fun to play with and to experiment. But there are a lot of people now with the way celebrity is and, you know, the Food Network and all that, they come out of culinary school thinking that they can be a chef. And being a chef is a lot more than just being able to be a creative cook.
It's funny that this whole idea of food celebrity or food TV, one of the folks that you've worked with, of course, is Dale Levitsky, you know, and he was on Top Chef and, you know, he did really well. I think it's what's really interesting about it is food TV tends to get vilified a lot, but it seems, at least in Dale's case, it seems that he was sort of reborn as a cook in some ways. It seems like he found his traction, or he found his
inner chef.
His inner chef, as he said, yeah.
Actually, Dale works here.
Yeah.
Now, and Dale is an old friend of mine. I gave Dale his first cooking job, and unbeknownst to me, he considered me a mentor in his career, which I did not know until the show. And I think he did have the opportunity to find his inner chef, which for him, he was going through a lot of personal stuff and really needed to get back to one place, get back to the center. And I think that allowed him to do that. He did phenomenally well, and, you know, we're very proud of him. And just as a friend, I'm proud of my friend.
Yeah. Was he robbed? Or does he think Hung was better, or it was just one of those days, or nobody knows?
You know, I think that his food is fantastic. He is very creative, very clever, and I didn't taste Hung's food. And not being able to be a judge there tasting all the plates, I couldn't really give you that answer.
Mm-hmm.
Consistently across the board, Hung was a little bit more consistent, but I didn't taste his food. But as Dale put it, second place is the new black.
This is true. Plus, you don't get locked into those bad contracts and all that, because I know they have those like ironclad deals and stuff with these TVs when they win.
Right.
And one of the things that I think is interesting is just the name of the restaurant, Sola, and I know it's about the sun, and it's also, I think I've heard you talk about how it's the feminization of the word solo, you know, which I guess this is this idea of you on your own in some ways. Or I wonder if you could talk about that, or why that's important to you, or what that means to you.
Well, originally that's where that name came from, was that it's the feminine version of the word solo, because I'm now on my own, as opposed to being partnered with my sister. That's all it meant to me, was just, okay, now I'm solo. In retrospect, I'm not on my own, because I have a partner, I have investors, I have a general manager who's now a partner, I have assistant managers, I've got an incredible staff in the kitchen and in the front of the house, so I'm really not on my own, because I'm a big believer in you are only as good as the people who work for you. So I wouldn't be where I am, who I am, and we would not be that without all of them. So, in fact, I'm not Sola. But you know, that's the name of the restaurant.
Yeah.
I have some friends in Los Angeles who thought it was a funny little play on, oh, it's so L.A., because that's where I was raised. So it has multiple meanings.
What was it like working with your sister? I mean, you hear a lot about partnerships, and, you know, I've interviewed chefs who've been married, of course, like Rick Tremonto and Gail Gand, and, you know, it's funny that their business partnership is better than their personal relationship was, you know, and I wonder what that's like for you.
Working with my sister was great, and it wasn't great. You know, working with any family member can be tough. It can be challenging. My sister came up with the idea to do the restaurant and really gave me a big break in this industry, and I'm grateful for that. But we just fought towards the end, and it was a better way to salvage our relationship, and we are now friends, and, you know, I'm the aunt to her children, and it's great. It's a difficult thing to do, and I think it requires the right kind of personalities and a lot of patience and tolerance from both sides.
I know you guys are different restaurants in many ways, and do you guys still have, like, a healthy sense of competition between the two of you, or is there anything like that, or is it more about, like, you know, helping each other out or the community?
It's become a lot more of helping each other out. She actually emailed me recently for some advice about something that she was doing, and, you know, and I gave it to her, and I offer her help anytime, and she would do the same for me, and I think that that's a more valuable relationship.
I know you're a celebrity, or you cooked for celebrities, and I know that you don't want to talk about, you know, we had talked about, you know, Jack Nicholson and James Garner, I think, were two that you cooked for, and I completely respect that you don't want to talk about their proclivities and anything like that. But I'm just curious what that's like. Is it exciting to do that? Or, you know, I've heard in the past, I think from other people who've done it, that, you know, celebrities are surprisingly, like, boring, or they don't like, you know, to be you to be creative as a chef. I just met somebody recently who's doing it in L.A., but I wonder if that's true.
Well, for the most part, I mean, you and I are equally as boring. I mean, you know, we like to sit down to just basic comfort kind of food, or, you know, we don't want to eat caviar and truffles every night of the week.
I might. No.
Yeah. As I said that, I thought to myself, I should put my foot back in my mouth. But they do tend to like basic things that they're used to and comfortable with. I don't find either one of them boring. I thought Jack is a very fascinating man and very interesting and very intelligent. It was a great job. The novelty eventually wears off. I mean, when you first start, you know, you're working for this big celebrity, and people, I would be out and people would say to me, oh, you're Jack Nicholson's chef. And I was like, I'm nobody. I just happen to cook for somebody, you know. But it's a great gig. But I wanted to do something else, is what it got down to. James Garner as well was just a lovely, charming, kind man. Just fantastic. But, you know, do you want to work in someone's home? And, you know, I wanted to make, not so much make a name for myself. I never really did this seeking fame. We all want to do something in life that is challenging to ourselves and makes us feel as though we've succeeded and accomplished something.
Sure.
And I know now I can die pretty comfortably knowing that I created a successful restaurant on my own and made people happy and did some great things. And
yeah, I mean, that's the bargain to mortality, right? We want to leave our place in the world.
You know,
because you're only here for a short period of time, so, you know, you work as hard as you can and try to make that mark if you can.
Yeah, and in this industry, it's a labor of love, because you've got to love what you do. And I work really, really hard, and I work really long hours. And sometimes I wonder what for. But the end result is that it makes me happy, and I know that I will feel like I've accomplished something.
The short ribs here are really good, but you don't eat a lot of meat. I wondered about that, you know, a chef not eating a lot of meat, or, you know, there's no reason you can't be a vegetarian or be vegetarian inclined or fish inclined, but I'm just curious about that. Is that just a personal choice for you, or, you know, a health choice? And, you know, it's like, because one of the things you think about when you're chefs eat everything, and, you know, and I'm guessing you do eat meat, you just don't eat a lot of it, but...
I do. I actually was a vegetarian for many years when I was younger. When I started cooking professionally, I started eating meat, because I think that it's necessary that you taste things. You know, clearly there's a lot that you can smell. Salt being an aromatic allows you to be able to taste something by smelling it. But I think that it's important to taste things with your mouth as well. I do eat meat, but I don't really enjoy it. So it's just a personal, it's not a religious or moral or health. I just have never been a big meat eater, even when I was a child. I eat chicken, I eat fish. I love vegetables. But I love bacon.
Yeah.
Who doesn't like bacon? You know, but I'm just not one that can sit down to a steak. But I'll always take a little bite off of Steve's plate when we're out to dinner or something, because he's a meat and potatoes guy. We've had bacon tempura here. We've had candied bacon. I make bacon brittle ice cream. We wrap everything we can in bacon. You know, it tastes so good. It smells good. We make our own bacon.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
What do you care it from?
We just peppercorns and ginger and lemongrass. And
ooh, that sounds good.
And it's just really delicious.
It's interesting this, because as you talk about the vegetarianism, it reminds me, there's a lot of chefs like that. I mean, I know Chef Noah at the Aria. He grew up macrobiotic.
Really?
And he
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's funny because his last meal is actually, he says, it's brown rice and like miso soup, you know, because that's what he grew up with, and it's like for him that's comfort and that's childhood.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And I know Nathan Klingbeil, who's he's a sous chef at Alinea now. He used to work at Schwa, and he grew up vegetarian, strict vegetarian, and now of course he eats meat for, you know, the chef restaurant purpose, but there's a lot of chefs, it seems like, who've gone that way.
Yeah, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, being healthy or eating, you know, eating well and being healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not object to meat at all. I'm not object to anything. I sit there and watch, what's that guy's name, Andrew Zimmern.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, some of the stuff that guy eats. And I used to think that Anthony Bourdain was a little bit wacky, but oh, my God.
Yeah. I saw the bug. He was, like, eating all those bugs and, like, tarantulas and all that crazy.
Okay, that to me isn't as disturbing as the pig testicles.
Oh, yeah.
Steve and I were watching that. He had to get up from the couch.
Yeah, he definitely...
That's disturbing.
He goes pretty far. I mean, the thing is, you know, I think if it tastes good, it tastes good. And, you know, I mean, I definitely believe in, like, sort of the Fergus Henderson sort of, you know, nose to tail. If you know, I love a lot of offal meat, you know, but there are some things that just aren't good, you know. And so then it's about shock value, so it's not really worth anything, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I had the, because I my motto is I will try anything twice, because how do you know the first time it wasn't cooked very well? You know, but that being said, you know, if it's not good, it's not good. And I had they have goat eyeball tacos at the Maxwell Street Market on Sundays.
I love
it. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I got to try it. Maybe it's good. If it's made it this long, you know, maybe there's something to it. And it was horrible. I'm never going to tell anybody that goat eyeballs are good. But, you know, foie gras is great. And, you know, I love really good, you know, kidneys that are prepared well. And I've had Brands Masala on Devon. So I've had some things that are really, really good. But, yeah, I think that some of that stuff, I'm sure most of those bugs don't taste really good.
Now, it's, for me, a lot of it is texture. I got a texture problem.
Yeah.
Like, I will only eat sweetbreads a certain way.
Yeah.
And when they're done right, they're great. But when they're not done right, the texture is just so difficult.
Thank you for doing it.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill podcast. I hope you enjoyed the interview. If you have any feedback, please drop me a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. We'll see you soon, and in the meantime, stay hungry.